They waded through the all-encroaching dust in a series of huge, dark-pillared halls which had been carved out of the solid rock. With some cunning, too, from floor to ceiling the walls were a mass of statues, gargoyles, bas-reliefs, and fluted columns that cast weirdly moving shadows when the dragon gave an obliging illumination at Two Flowers' request. They crossed the lengthy galleries and vast carven amphitheatres, all awash with deep, soft dust and completely uninhabited. No one had come to these dead caverns in centuries. Then he saw the path, leading away into yet another dark tunnel mouth. Someone had been using it regularly and recently. It was a deep, narrow trail in the grey blanket. Twoflower followed it. It led through still more lofty halls and winding corridors quite big enough for a dragon. And dragons had come this way once, it seemed. There was a room full of rotting harness, dragon-sized, and another room containing plate and chainmail big enough for elephants. They ended in a pair of green bronze doors, each so high that they disappeared into the gloom. In front of Twoflower, at chest height, was a small handle shaped like a brass dragon. When he touched it, the doors swung open instantly and with a disconcerting noiselessness. Instantly, sparks crackled in Twoflower's hair, and there was a sudden gust of hot, dry wind that didn't disturb the dust in the way that ordinary wind should, but instead whipped it up momentarily into unpleasantly half-living shapes before it settled again. In Twoflower's ears came the strange, shrill twittering of the things locked in the distant dungeon dimensions out beyond the fragile lattice of time and space. Shadows appeared where there was nothing to cause them. The air buzzed like a hive. In short, there was a vast discharge of magic going on around him. The chamber beyond the door was lit by a pale green glow. Stacked around the walls, each on its own marble shelf, were tier upon tier of coffins. In the centre of the room was a stone chair on a raised dais, and it contained a slumped figure which did not move, but said in a brittle old voice,
"Come in, young man."
Twoflower stepped forward. The figure in the seat was human, as far as he could make out in the murky light, but there was something about the awkward way it was sprawled in the chair that made him glad he couldn't see it any clearer.
"I'm dead, you know,"
came a voice from what Twoflower fervently hoped was a head, in conversational tones.
"I expect you can tell."
Said Twoflower.
"Yes,"
he began to back away.
"Obvious, isn't it?"
agreed the voice.
"You'd be Twoflower, wouldn't you? Or is that later?"
"Later?" said Twoflower. "Later than what?" He stopped.
"Well," said the voice, "you see, one of the advantages of being dead is that one is released, as it were, from the bonds of time, and therefore I can see everything that has happened or will happen all at the same time, except that, of course, I now know that time does not, for all practical purposes, exist."
"That doesn't sound like a disadvantage," said Twoflower.
"You don't think so? Imagine every moment being at one and the same time a distant memory and a nasty surprise, and you'll see what I mean. Anyway, I now recall what it was I'm about to tell you, or have I already done so? That's a fine-looking dragon, by the way. Or don't I say that yet?"
"It is rather good. It just turned up," said Twoflower.
"It turned up?" said the voice. "You summoned it?"
"Yes, well, all I did..."
"You have the power?"
"All I did was think of it."
"That's what the power is. Have I already told you that I am Graycha the First? Or is that next? I'm sorry, but I haven't had too much experience of transcendence. Anyway, yes, the power. It summons dragons, you know."
"I think you already told me that," said Twoflower.
"Did I? I certainly intended to,"
said the dead man. "But how does it? I've been thinking about dragons all my life, but this is the first time one's turned up."
"Oh, well, you see, the truth of the matter is that dragons have never existed as you, and until I was poisoned some 3 months ago, I understand existence. I'm talking about the true dragon. Draconis nobilis, you understand. The swamp dragon, Draconis vulgaris, is a base creature and not worth our consideration. The true dragon, on the other hand, is a creature of such refinement of spirit that they can only take on form in this world if they are conceived by the most skilled imagination. And even then the said imagination must be in some place heavily impregnated with magic, which helps to weaken the walls between the world of the seen and the unseen. Then the dragons pop through, as it were, and impress their form on this world's possibility matrix. I was very good at it when I was alive. I could imagine up to, 500 dragons at a time. Now Liesa, the most skilled of my children, can barely imagine 50 rather nondescript creatures. So much for a progressive education. She doesn't really believe in them. That's why her dragons are rather boring, while yours, said the voice of Gracia, is almost as good as some of mine used to be. A sight for sore eyes. Not that I have any to speak of now.
Two Flowers said hurriedly, You keep saying you're dead.
Well?
Well, the dead, they, you know, don't talk much, as a rule.
I used to be an exceptionally powerful wizard. My daughter poisoned me, of course. It is the generally accepted method of succession in our family. But...
The corpse sighed, or at least a sigh came from the air a few feet above it.
It soon became obvious that none of my three children is sufficiently powerful to wrest the lordship of the Wilmberg from the other two. A most unsatisfactory arrangement. A kingdom like ours has to have one ruler. So I resolved to remain alive in an unofficial capacity, which of course annoys them all immensely. I won't give my children the satisfaction of burying me until there is only one of them left to perform the ceremony.
There was a nasty wheezing noise. Two Flower decided that it was meant to be a chuckle. So it was one of them that kidnapped us, said Two Flower.
Liesa, said the dead wizard's voice. My daughter. Her power is strongest, you know. My son's dragons are incapable of flying more than a few miles before they fade.
Fade? I did notice that we could see through the one that brought us here, said Two Flower. I thought that was a bit odd.
Of course, said Gracia. The power only works near the Wyrmberg. It's the inverse square law, you know. At least I think it is. As the dragons fly further away, they begin to dwindle. Otherwise, my little Liesa would be ruling the whole world by now, if I know anything about it. But I can see I mustn't keep you. I expect you'll be wanting to rescue your friend.
Two Flower gaped. Harun, he said.
Not him. The skinny wizard. My son, Leort, is trying to hack him to pieces. I admired the way you rescued him. Will, I mean.
Two Flower drew himself up to his full height. An easy task. Where is he? He said, heading towards the door with what he hoped was an heroic stride.
Just follow the pathway in the dust, said the voice. Liesa comes to see me sometimes. She still comes to see her old dad, my little girl. She was the only one with the strength of character to murder me. A chip off the old block. Good luck, by the way. I seem to recall I said that. Will say it now, I mean.
The rambling voice got lost in a maze of tenses as Two Flower ran along the dead tunnels, with the dragon loping along easily behind him. But soon he was leaning against a pillar completely out of breath. It seemed ages since he'd had anything to eat. "Why don't you fly?" said Nine Reeds inside his head. The dragon spread its wings and gave an experimental flap, which lifted it momentarily off the ground. Two Flower stared for a moment, then ran forward and clambered quickly onto the beast's neck. Soon they were airborne, the dragon skimming along easily a few feet from the floor and leaving a billowing cloud of dust in its wake. Two Flower hung on as best he could as Nine Reeds swooped through a succession of caverns and soared around a spiral staircase that could easily have accommodated a retreating army. At the top they emerged into the more inhabited regions, the mirrors at every corridor corner brightly polished and reflecting a pale light.
"I smell other dragons."
The wings became a blur, and Two Flower was jerked back as the dragon veered and sped off down a side corridor like a gnat-crazed swallow. Another sharp turn sent them soaring out of a tunnel mouth in the side of a vast cavern. There were rocks far below, and up above were broad shafts of light from great holes near the roof. A lot of activity on the ceiling, too, as Nine Reeds hovered, thumping the air with his wings. Two Flower peered up at the shapes of roosting beasts and tiny men-shaped dots that were somehow walking upside down.
"This is a roosting hall," said the dragon in a satisfied tone.
As Two Flower watched, one of the shapes far above detached itself from the roof and began to grow larger. Rincewind watched as Leo-t-rt's pale face dropped away from him. "This is funny," gibbered a small part of his mind. "Why am I rising?" Then he began to tumble in the air, and reality took over. He was dropping to the distant, guano-speckled rocks. His brain reeled with the thought. The words of the spell, picked just that moment to surface from the depths of his mind, as they always did in times of crisis. "Why not say us?" they seemed to urge. "What have you got to lose?" Rincewind waved a hand in the gathering slipstream. "Ashonai," he called. The word formed in front of him in a cold blue flame that streamed in the wind. He waved the other hand, drunk with terror and magic. "Ebiris," he intoned. The sound froze into a flickering orange word that hung beside its companion. "Urshoring, Kavantai, Python, Ngurad, Feringomali." As the words blazed their rainbow colours around him, he flung his hands back and prepared to say the eighth and final word that would appear in coruscating octarine and seal the spell. The imminent rocks were forgotten. He began. The breath was knocked out of him. The spell scattered and snuffed out. A pair of arms locked around his waist, and the whole world jerked sideways as the dragon rose out of its long dive, claws grazing just for a moment the topmost rock on the Wyrmberg's noisome floor. Two Flower laughed triumphantly. "Got him!" And the dragon, curving gracefully at the top of his flight, gave a lazy flip of his wings and soared through a cave mouth into the morning air. At noon, in a wide green meadow on the lush tableland that was the top of the impossibly balanced Wyrmberg, the dragons and their riders formed a wide circle. There was room beyond them for a rabble of servants and slaves and others who scratched a living here on the roof of the world, and they were all watching the figures clustered in the centre of the grassy arena. The group contained a number of senior dragon lords, and among them were Leo-t-rt and his brother Liartes. The former was still rubbing his legs with small grimaces of pain. Slightly to one side stood Liesa and Hrun, with some of the woman's own followers. Between the two factions stood the Wyrmberg's hereditary lawmaster.
"As you know," he said uncertainly, "the not fully late Lord of the Wyrmberg, Greychar the First, has stipulated that there will be no succession until one of his children feels himself, or as it might be, herself, powerful enough to challenge and defeat his or her siblings in mortal combat."
"Yes, yes, we know all that. Get on with it," said a thin, peevish voice from the air beside him.
The lawmaster swallowed. He had never come to terms with his former master's failure to expire properly. "Is the old buzzard dead, or isn't he?" he wondered.
"It is not certain," he quavered, "whether it is allowable to issue a challenge by proxy."
"It is, it is," snapped Gracher's disembodied voice. "It shows intelligence. Don't take all day about it."
"I challenge you," said Harun, glaring at the brothers, "both at once."
Leo-t-rt and Liartes exchanged looks.
"You'll fight us both together?" said Liartis, a tall, wiry man with long black hair.
"Yeah."
"That's pretty uneven odds, isn't it?"
"Yeah, I outnumber you 1-2.
Liotrt scowled.
"You arrogant barbarian!"
"That just about does it," growled Hurun.
The lawmaster put out a blue-veined hand to restrain him.
"It is forbidden to fight on the killing ground," he said,
and paused while he considered the sense of this. "You know what I mean, anyway," he hazarded, giving up, and added, "As the challenged parties, my lords Liotrt and Liartis, have choice of weapons."
"Dragons,"
they said together. Liesa snorted.
"Dragons can be used offensively, therefore they are weapons,"
said Liotrt firmly.
"If you disagree, we can fight over it."
"Ya,"
said his brother, nodding at Hrun. The lawmaster felt a ghostly finger prod him in the chest.
"Don't stand there with your mouth open,"
said Gracher's graveyard voice.
"Just hurry up, will you?"
Hrun stepped back, shaking his head.
"Oh, no," he said. "Once was enough. I'd rather be dead than fight on one of those things."
"Die, then," said the lawmaster, as kindly as he could manage. Liotrt and Liartes were already striding back across the turf to where the servants stood waiting with their mounts. Hrun turned to Liesa. She shrugged.
"Don't I even get a sword?" he pleaded. "A knife, even?"
"No," she said. "I didn't expect this."
She suddenly looked smaller, all defiance gone.
"I'm sorry."
"You're sorry?"
"Yes, I'm sorry."
"Yes, I thought you'd said you were sorry."
"Don't glare at me like that. I can imagine you the finest dragon to ride."
"No."
The lawmaster wiped his nose on a handkerchief, held the little silken square aloft for a moment, then let it fall. A boom of wings made Hrun spin round. Liotrt's dragon was already airborne and circling around towards them. As it swooped low over the turf, a billow of flame shot from its mouth, scoring a black streak across the grass that rushed towards Hrun. At the last minute he pushed Liesa aside and felt the wild pain of the flame on his arm as he dived for safety. He rolled as he hit the ground and flipped onto his feet again while he looked around frantically for the other dragon. It came in from one side, and Hrun was forced to take a badly judged standing jump to escape the flame. The dragon's tail whipped around as it passed and caught him a stinging blow across the forehead. He pushed himself upright, shaking his head to make the wheeling stars go away. His blistered back screamed pain at him. Liotrt came in for a second run, but slower this time to allow for the big man's unexpected agility. As the ground drifted up, he saw the barbarian standing stock still, chest heaving, arms hanging loosely by his sides. An easy target. As a dragon swooped away, Liotrt turned his head, expecting to see a dreadfully big cinder. There was nothing there. Puzzled, Liotrt turned back. Hrun, heaving himself over the dragon's shoulder scales with one hand and beating out his flaming hair with the other, presented himself to his view. Liotrt's hand flew to his dagger, but pain had sharpened Hrun's normally excellent reflexes to needle point. A backhand blow hammered into the dragon lord's wrist, sending the dagger arcing away towards the ground, and another caught the man full on the chin. The dragon, carrying the weight of two men, was only a few yards above the grass. This turned out to be fortunate, because at the moment Liotrt lost consciousness, the dragon winked out of existence. Liesa hurried across the grass and helped Hrun stagger to his feet. He blinked at her.
"What happened? What happened?" he said thickly.
"That was really fantastic," she said. "The way you turned that somersault in mid-air and everything."
"Yeah, but what happened?"
"It's rather difficult to explain."
Hrun peered up at the sky. Liartes, by far the most cautious of the two brothers, was circling high above them.
"Well, you've got about 10 seconds to try," he said. "The dragons."
"Yeah?"
"They're imaginary."
"Like all these imaginary burns on my arm, you mean?"
"Yes, no," she shook her head violently. "I'll have to tell you later."
"Fine, if you can find a really good medium," snapped Hrun.
He glared up at Liartes, who was beginning to descend in wide sweeps.
"Just listen, will you? Unless my brother is conscious, his dragon can't exist. It's got no pathway through to this..."
"'Run!' shouted Hrun. He threw her away from him and flung himself flat on the ground as Liarte's dragon thundered by, leaving another smoking scar across the turf. While the creature sought height for another sweep, Hrun scrambled to his feet and set off at a dead run for the woods at the edge of the arena. They were sparse, little more than a wide and overgrown hedge, but at least no dragon would be able to fly through them. It didn't try. Liartes brought his mount in to land on the turf a few yards away and dismounted casually. The dragon folded its wings and poked its head in among the greenery, while its master leaned against a tree and whistled tunelessly.
"I can burn you out," said Liartes after a while.
The bushes remained motionless.
"Perhaps you're in that holly bush over there."
The holly bush became a waxy ball of flame.
"I'm sure I can see movement in those ferns."
The ferns became mere skeletons of white ash.
"You're only prolonging it, barbarian. Why not give in now? I've burned lots of people. It doesn't hurt a bit,"
said Liartes, looking sideways at the bushes. The dragon continued through the spinney, incinerating every likely-looking bush and clump of ferns. Liartes drew his sword and waited. Hrun dropped from a tree and landed running. Behind him, the dragon roared and crashed through the bushes as it tried to turn round, but Hrun was running with his gaze fixed on Liartes and a dead branch in his hands. It is a little-known but true fact that a two-legged creature can usually beat a four-legged creature over a short distance, simply because of the time it takes the quadruped to get its legs sorted out. Hrun heard the scrabble of claws behind him, and then an ominous thump. The dragon had half opened its wings and was trying to fly. As Hrun bore down on the dragon lord, Liarte's sword came up wickedly to be caught on the branch. Then Hrun cannoned into him, and the two men sprawled on the ground. The dragon roared. Liarte's screamed as Hrun brought a knee upwards with anatomical precision, but managed a wild blow that re-broke the barbarian's nose for him. Hrun kicked away and scrambled to his feet, to find himself looking up into the wild, hoarse face of the dragon, its nostrils distended. He lashed out with a foot and caught Liartes, who was trying to stand up, on the side of his head. The man slumped. The dragon vanished. The ball of fire that was billowing towards Hrun faded, until when it reached him, it was no more than a puff of warm air. Then there was no sound but the crackle of burning bushes. Hrun slung the unconscious dragon lord over his shoulder and set off at a trot back to the arena. Halfway there, he found Liot-Urt sprawled on the ground, one leg bent awkwardly. He stooped and, with a grunt, hoisted the man onto his vacant shoulder. Liesa and the Lawmaster were waiting on a raised dais at one end of the meadow. The dragon woman had quite recovered her composure now and looked levelly at Hrun as he threw the two men down on the steps before her. The people around her were standing in deferential poses, like a court.
"Kill them," she said.
"I kill in my own time," he said. "In any case, killing unconscious people isn't right." "I can't think of a more opportune time," said the Lawmaster.
Liesa snorted.
"Then I shall banish them," she said. "Once they are beyond the reach of the Wyrmberg's magic, then they'll have no power. They'll be simply brigands. Will that satisfy you?"
"Yes."
"I am surprised that you are so merciful, Hrun
shrugged.
"A man in my position, he can't afford to be anything else. He's got to consider his image."
He looked around.
"Where's the next test, then?"
"I warn you that it is perilous. If you wish, you may leave now. If you pass the test, however, you will become Lord of the Wyrmberg, and, of course, my lawful husband."
Hrun met her gaze. He thought about his life to date. It suddenly seemed to him to have been full of long, damp nights, sleeping under the stars, desperate fights with trolls, city guards, countless bandits, and evil priests, and, on at least three occasions, actual demigods. And for what? Well, for quite a lot of treasure, he had to admit. But where had it all gone? Rescuing beleaguered maidens had a certain passing reward, but most of the time he'd finished up by setting them up in some city somewhere with a handsome dowry, because after a while even the most agreeable ex-maiden became possessive, and had scant sympathy for his efforts to rescue her sister sufferers. In short, life had really left him with little more than a reputation and a network of scars. Being a lord might be fun. Hrun grinned. With a base like this, all these dragons, and a good bunch of fighting men, a man could really be a contender. Besides, the wench was not uncomely.
"The third test," she said.
"Am I to be weaponless again?" said Harun.
Liesa reached up and removed her helmet, letting the coils of red hair tumble out. Then she unfastened the brooch of her robe. Underneath, she was naked. As Harun's gaze swept over her, his mind began to operate two notional counting machines. One assessed the gold in her bangles, the tiger rubies that ornamented her toe rings, the diamond spangle that adorned her navel, and two highly individual whirligigs of silver filigree. The other was plugged straight into his libido. Both produced tallies that pleased him mightily. As she raised a hand and proffered a glass of wine, she smiled and said,
"I think not."
Thank you.